I basically want to tell the story of the Austrian school. Actually, I want to tell two stories. One is a conventional story, as it's been told about the history and revival of the Austrian school up through the early 90s. This was accepted by almost all contemporary Austrian economists. And the second story is the revisionist story that has been developed more or less during the 1990s. The revisionist story, the second story, focuses or emphasizes very heavily the place of two important books in the history of the Austrian school. Human Action by Ludwig von Mises, which appeared in 1949. There was a German language forerunner that was published in 1940 in Switzerland called National Economie. And Man, Economy, and State, which was published in 1962, by Murray Rothbard. Let me give you the conventional story of the Austrian school. Now, the conventional story tends to be a story that the Austrian tradition was always, from the beginning, a unified tradition, and that it continued to be unified after the Austrian school was revived, according to this story, in 1974. Okay, the modern revival of the Austrian school, according to the conventional story, dates from 1974. There were certainly some disagreements within the Austrian school, both the older and the newer Austrian school, but that these disagreements were minor and the Austrian school presented a broad, unified front to the world. The second story, I think, is based on deeper research and shows that there were differences in the Austrian school right from the beginning, and that these same differences reappeared and, in fact, were sharpened after the Austrian school was revived, according to this story, in 1962. Okay, I'm a proponent of the second story, and I've been involved in some of the research that really developed this sort of telling of the story of the Austrian school. So let me give you the conventional story. The conventional story starts with Karl Menger, who I discussed in one of the first lectures this week. Both sides, and I'll call them the homogenists, those who believe the Austrian school is one homogeneous tradition, and the dehomogenists, those who believe that actually there are a number of different strands in the Austrian school that are separate and unique. So the first story, everyone agrees that Menger was the founder of the Austrian school. His first students were von Bawerk and von Bawerk's brother-in-law, Friedrich von Wieser. And they developed different areas of Menger's work. I think most people would agree that von Bawerk was the more creative of the two. And then there was a third generation of brilliant students. They were Mises, Schumpeter, who really later became from the beginning was a general equilibrium theorist, so he's Austrian by birth, but not really a part of the Austrian school. But for this story, he has important influence on the Austrian school. A lesser known individual named Richard von Spriegel, and Hans Meyer. Then in the fourth generation, these were the Austrian economists who, along with Mises and Schumpeter, left Austria during the 1930s, beginning with Hayek, Fritz Machlup. Hayek went to the London School of Economics and spread the Austrian business cycle theory in Great Britain and also in the United States. Fritz Machlup came to the United States in the mid-1930s. He started at University of Buffalo and wound up at Princeton and NYU. Gottfried Hobler, who wrote a famous book on the Great Depression during the mid-1930s under the auspices of the League of Nations, and then got a position at Harvard University. And Oscar Morgenstern, who was considered one of the fathers of game theory, who wrote one of the first books as a co-author with John von Neumann, the subject of, John von Neumann was a famous mathematician. And Morgenstern also wound up at Princeton, okay, in the same institute where Einstein taught. Now, this story goes as follows, that by the early 1930s, the Austrian theory of the business cycle had swept the industrialized nations. That is, that the economics profession had embraced the Austrian theory of the business cycle because, unlike the standard theory of money and business cycles, which was developed more or less by Irving Fisher in the United States and certain British economists like Dennis Robertson and another British economist named Hawtrey, Fisher's theory, okay, Fisher was the main monetary economist in the U.S., was simply that if the Fed was able to hold the money, the price level stable, as it did do in the 1920s, business cycles would be forever banished. Okay, we would have an era of perpetual prosperity, and that's what the 20s was called, an era of perpetual prosperity. Okay, even though there was tremendous technological improvement and productivity increases in the 1920s, there was no boom as Fisher and his followers understood that. There were no rising prices. The level of prices was fairly stable. Wholesale prices were slightly lower at the end of the 1920s than they were at the beginning of the 1920s. Okay, so Fisher claimed that, look, the Fed kept the economy stable, kept the price level stable. Therefore, since there was no boom, there'll be no bust. And Fisher claimed that the business cycle had been banished and that this was, in fact, the era of perpetual prosperity. The stock market was booming. Real estate in certain parts of the country were booming. But this was considered to be a solid boom, a boom based on real factors because there was no inflation in the sense of an increase in prices. It was only the Austrians, both Hayek and Mises in particular, who claimed that this was really an unstable and unhealthy boom in the United States. Hayek had toured the United States in 1924, and as early as 1924 said that the Fed was keeping the money supply, the price level stable by increasing the money supply. And so that the stable price level, okay, actually disguised the fact that there was a tremendous amount of monetary inflation. If the Fed had not increased the money supply, because of the tremendous increase in productivity, both prices and costs would have fallen in the U.S. economy. So, in fact, Fisher and his followers were wrong. The so-called quantity theorists were wrong that there was an unstable boom underway in the United States. And Hayek made the prediction that this would come to an end at some point. Okay, he didn't give any timing. Then in the late 1920s, Mises, and who was in charge of the Business Cycle Institute in Vienna, in the publications of that institute, there were predictions that, in fact, this boom was unstable and that it would come to an end. And at one point, Motlop, who was a friend of Mises and in the generation after Mises, was walking with Mises past the famous Austrian bank that was one of the first large banks to collapse in Europe, the Credit Anstalt. And evidently, Mises had been asked to become the president of that bank in the late 20s. And so Motlop said, well, why haven't you accepted the position? And Mises pointed to the bank and said, there's going to be a great smash, and this will be one of the first institutions to fall. Okay. So Mises was convinced that there was a worldwide inflation that was going to end in some sort of a depression. To make a long story short, when the depression actually hit in 1929, the Austrians were the only school of thought ready with an explanation. Okay. Fisher kept saying in 1930, 1931, prosperity, along with Hoover, he was saying prosperity is right around the corner. Okay. And in fact, it wasn't. In fact, he lost his wife's inheritance. Okay. He actually believed that the stock market boom was firm and wouldn't end. In other words, it was very similar to what was happening in the 1990s, that there was, in some sense, a new economy, a new era that was ushered in by wise Fed management. So the Austrians then began to have a very wide influence based on their business cycle theory, both in the United States and Great Britain. And you had many, many economists who later on became Keynesians under the influence of Hayek at the London School of Economics, where he taught, and under the influence of Motlop, who wrote a book on the stock market boom and crash in the 1930s and was teaching in the United States. So under the influence of a number of Austrians, this was the explanation of the business cycle that was accepted by the economics profession. It was beginning to become widely accepted by the economics profession at large. Okay, unfortunately for the Austrians, the story goes, their policy prescription was the Fed must stop inflating. It must not try to reinflate the economy, that is, inflate its way out of the depression. The Fed must not try to prop up wages and prices, particularly prices of farm products and of industrial labor, okay, because this would only cause worse unemployment and worse unsold surpluses. Okay. They should not engage in things like the refinance, the RFC, which was started by Hoover and continued under Roosevelt, which would subsidize cheap loans. They shouldn't engage in public works and so on. So the Austrians counseled hands-off, something that governments are always loath to do. The Austrians said that there should be a balanced budget, that you should not try to spend more than you take in taxes, and in fact you should cut both spending and taxes. Okay, so the policy prescriptions that they gave were counter to what governments are inclined to do. And then, with the depression growing worse and worse, and actually Great Britain began to come out of the depression because they seemed to have inflated in the early 1930s. In 1931, they went off the gold standard. They began to inflate. The pound devalued. Keynes wrote a book, The General Theory. Okay, and that ushered in the Keynesian Revolution. And of course, Keynes had a very simple explanation for the recession or depression and how we should get out of it. He simply said, look, if there is a depression, it implies that there's too little spending by households and businesses. Okay? And because of pessimism, animal spirits on the part of businessmen were suddenly turned pessimistic. Consumers were then frightened and their incomes were shrinking, so they were spending less. So that the government should step in and pump up spending. And it could do it by running deficits and also by pushing down the interest rate by increasing the money supply and with lower interest rates, stimulating investment. So Keynes emphasized the former, that is, direct government deficits, injecting spending directly into the economy. So there was a Keynesian revolution, and the Austrian theory of the business cycle was forgotten, just poured down what Rothbard calls the Orwellian memory hole. It was never refuted. It was simply forgotten. Because Keynes gave a much more attractive set of policy prescriptions to government. So, in this conventional view, then, okay, you have things starting with Menger, or rather here, 1871, we have things starting with Menger. The next important event is really 1936. The Austrian school supposedly grew continually, okay, and became more and more influential from 1871 to 1936. And a lot of these intervening events were not important, which they will be important when I discuss the revisionist view. Alright, well, then what occurred was that Mises wrote Human Action. The conventional view doesn't put too much stock in this as influencing the revival of the Austrian school. They think it's a great book, and that Mises was taught in the United States through the 1950s and through the 60s. He retired, I believe, in 1969. At the ripe old age of, I think, 89 years old. But they claim that, or the claim is made that suddenly in 1974, okay, a conference was held by the Institute for Humane Studies at South Royalton in Vermont. And almost spontaneously, all these young Austrians showed up. It's almost like the movie about baseball. Okay, what's that? Yeah, Field of Dreams. I'm thinking of The Natural, but yeah, Field of Dreams. Okay, if you hold it, they will come. Okay, so there were three main speakers at the South Royalton Conference: Murray Rothbard, Israel Kirzner, and Ludwig Lachmann. Okay, who was a research assistant for Hayek at London School of Economics in the early 1930s. This really leaves a lot out in the story. Okay, was it really true that the Austrian school was becoming more and more influential through World War I, through the 1920s, and then suddenly, suddenly, it just disappears. Okay, everyone forgets about it because Keynes writes one book that gives better policy prescriptions. Okay, could its influence have been that chicken-legged. In other words, it was standing on chicken legs. There was nothing substantial that it would just collapse because of one book. Okay? And secondly, is it really true that because of this one conference, and then later, and let me stress, Hayek's Nobel Prize, the conference was held in June of 74. Hayek won the Nobel Prize in October of 74. Those two events together explain the resurgence, the revival, and the resurgence of the Austrian school. Okay? So it's sort of the Big Bang theory of the disappearance of the Austrian school and the revival of the Austrian school. Okay? So was it really a Big Bang that destroyed the Austrian school and that caused it to revive? Okay? Did it come from nowhere in 1974 and suddenly explode into existence like the universe allegedly did at some point? Now, I've written two articles contesting this view. One article, they're both in the Quarterly Journal of Austrian Economics, and the first article contests the first part of the view, and that is the place of human action in the history of economic thought. Make sure that's the right complete title there. Yeah, the place of human action in the development of modern economic thought. Okay, that's, if you're interested, it's in the spring 1999 edition, okay, issue of the Quarterly Journal. And then I wrote an article contesting the second part of the view regarding the revival that has just come out in winter 2002 issue of the journal. And that's entitled The Rebirth of Austrian Economics in Light of Austrian Economics. All right, well, let me just give you some of the events that I think are important in this revisionist view. And what I want to do is just to point out that right from the beginning, there were two different strands of thought in the Austrian school. Okay, Bombaverk followed Menger pretty carefully and believed that the proper method of economics was to deduce the logical implications of the fact that human beings were trying to satisfy their wants or continually trying to satisfy their wants with elements of their environment. Okay? And Bombaverk went further than Menger because Bombaverk actually developed the theory to the point of a money exchange economy, even though he didn't have a satisfactory theory of money. Okay? Menger had pretty much stopped short at Robinson Crusoe economy, although he did have some element of price theory. So it was really Bombaverk that fully develop Menger's value theory into a viable price theory. Now, what Wieser did, and I'll mark this strand in green. Wieser, who was Bombaverk's brother-in-law, never really thought much about developing a realistic theory of prices like Bombaverk did. Basically, what Wieser wanted to do was to come up with some standard of how resources can be allocated in an optimal way, in a way that maximizes human welfare. And he used a communist economy to do that. He believed that people's values could directly be added up in some sense, summed up across the population. And that goods, the optimal allocation of goods was such that you maximize the total utility in society. Okay? And so he believed basically that if there were poor people or people who had very few resources, a redistribution from the people with more resources to the people with fewer resources, because of the law of marginal utility, he believed that you could compare utility between people, would result in an increase in utility. So he did use the law of marginal utility. He did use some aspects of Menger's system. He was very good at developing the notion of opportunity cost, that when you take resources from one area of the economy, when you expand one area of production in the economy, the opportunity cost is the important cost. That is what is given up in other areas of the economy. So he did extend and expand Austrian economics. But his view of Austrian economics, even though he himself wasn't mathematical, was in some sense a mathematical view. He really did believe, and he had a small system of equations, that you could solve the problem that faces socialism or communism of valuing all the different capital goods, all the different land resources, etc., by a system of equations. Okay? And he believed the market economy actually solved that system of equations every day. So though he wrote in a literary manner, he was a mathematically inclined economist. Okay, so What are some of the important events that occurred that brought down the Austrian school? Okay, it wasn't really the Big Bang, as far as I'm concerned. What happened was in 1889, by 1889, von Bawerk was seen as the leading Austrian economist. His work was read throughout, was translated into English. His three-volume treatise on capital and interest was debated in the journals in the Great Britain and the United States. The Austrian school, by the late 1880s, was beginning to get a worldwide reputation. Von Bawerk was seen as the most prominent, eminent Austrian economist. But then he quit academia. Okay, it's always a mistake to go into government service. Okay, and obviously his productivity suffered. Okay, now in the meantime, in 1890, Alfred Marshall, the British economist, whose work really dominated English-speaking economics in microtheory up through the 1930s, wrote his famous book on the principles of economics. Okay? And what began to happen was that over time, the influence of Menger and von Bawerk and their value and price theory in the English-speaking world began to wane, okay? Began to slip because more and more people began to read and be attracted to Marshall's principles, which purported to be a realistic book of how of the actual business of life. But for Marshall, realism didn't mean focusing on consumers and their wants and how they go about satisfying their wants. Realism simply meant partial equilibrium economics, looking at each market in an ad hoc way and discussing those markets. So it wasn't very systematic. Okay, it didn't appeal to the systematic mind. And unfortunately, the British don't tend to be systematic thinkers, okay? Unlike the Austrians and the French, to some extent. Okay. So that was happening. The Austrian influence was beginning to be countered by Marshallian economics. Then in 1902, Karl Menger, the great founder, retires. Menger has an odd view of the Austrian school. Menger believes that you never really have to try to maneuver in academic life to get people who believe in your system of economics to get them into various positions in the academic world. In other words, he stayed away from academic politicking. Okay, he stayed above it. He wouldn't even allow his book, The Principles, which was now out of print and was selling extremely high prices in used bookstores. He wouldn't allow it to be republished. Okay. It wasn't quite right, so he wanted to work on it, and he kept working on it until he died. He never really published a second edition of it. He didn't see the strategic importance of getting that book back into print to influence the next generation of economists. He wasn't a strategic thinker. In fact, there are statements that he makes that Hayek found in his papers when he went through Menger's papers. It says something like, "The only course to the truth is to allow every error to run its course. The only path to the truth is to allow every error to run its course." And he made statements like that, meaning, don't oppose error necessarily. Eventually, everyone will figure out that this is wrong. Okay. Now, what happened in the meantime was that the universities in Austria, in the Austrian-Hungarian Empire, the chairs of economics in the various universities were filled with people that were anti-Austrian economists and anti-economic. Okay, and they were the historical school, okay, the German historian. They hated Menger and von Bawerk. And von Bawerk pretty much followed Menger's lead in not attempting to form consciously a school of thought and to get an institutional infrastructure, to get people embedded in universities where they could train new economists. Okay. Despite the fact that he became two or three times he became the finance minister during the period that he was in government. Okay. Well, von Bawerk, unfortunately, Wieser then takes over Menger's chair at the University of Vienna. He becomes the main professor at the University of Vienna and is the one that influences, then, the fourth generation. Okay, now, the fourth generation comes up in 1918, 1919, after World War I. They're at the university, Hayek, Maklup, Hobler, and Morgenstern. In the meantime, Joseph Schumpeter, who then is taught when he comes to the university in 1904, he's taught by Wieser, and he considers Wieser his mentor. He's even more mathematical than Wieser. He is openly inclined to the general equilibrium method. And what Schumpeter does is to write a book on the nature and essence of theoretical economics in 1908. He's still a very, very young man. He's in his 20s. saying that the correct method of economics was what he called models or schema, and they were models of general equilibrium and models of partial equilibrium, Marshall's models. And he says these mathematical models form the core of theoretical economics. Any other type of approach to economics that dispenses with mathematical models is not science at all. Okay? Now that book becomes very important, makes him a very influential person. Then in 1911, he's trying to explain why we have business cycles, which you can't do in a system of mathematically simultaneous mathematical equations in which the economy is static. And he comes out with another book, The Theory of Economic Development, which makes him a worldwide influence at this point, in which he claims that the economy actually is in equilibrium until these great entrepreneurs, a few entrepreneurs at the same time, come up with different innovations, and somehow the banks respond by increasing the money supply, and there's a boom, and then there's a bust, and this is natural, and it's part of the market economy. Now, in the meantime, von Bauwerk is holding up. He comes back to academia in 1904. He's a tired old man, as he says himself. Mises says that his nerves are basically shot from the government, from the tremendous burden of government work. And he runs a seminar, though, once a week that's very successful, and Mises is in the seminar, Schumpeter's in the seminar. A number of very important Marxist economists, Otto Bauer attends a seminar, Otto Neurath attends a seminar, and others. And going in line with his idea that you should never attempt to push your ideas onto people, von Bauwerk allows everyone to speak in the seminar, okay, no matter how dumb they are, like Otto Neurath, who believed that you could add apples and oranges. He's a fanatical Marxist, and he just dominates the floor a lot many times, and, you know, just angers Mises. Instead of shutting the punk up or throwing him out or whatever, he doesn't do that because of this view of that Menger and von Bauwerk have that, you know, it's really geniuses that develop economics and all these other, you know, piddling people that write errors. They shouldn't be opposed. Eventually, their writings will simply fall. Their theoretical systems will fall because of self-contradiction and so on. So then von Bauwerk passes away in 1914. And what occurs is that Wieser continues to be the main professor at the University of Vienna. Von Bauwerk had a special chair created for him there. But Wieser teaches all the new students. And the new students also read Schumpeter's two books because he's the most famous Austrian economist. And then Wieser writes a book in 1914. I didn't write it in here. But that book is called Social Economics. It's the first general treatise from marginal utility economists of the Austrian persuasion. So basically, everyone who comes to the university after that is taught general equilibrium economics by Wieser, okay? And on their own, these younger people, and I have quotes in my article, they all think that Schumpeter's work is great. They say all of them report later on that they were heavily influenced as graduate students by Schumpeter's two books. Okay, now what does that bring us to? Well, here's where there's a big difference between the conventional view and the view that I espouse, that others espouse, and that is that all four of these people, including the great Hayek, were students of Wieser. Okay? They weren't students of von Bauwerk. He had died by 1914. Now, the story often goes, the conventional story, was that they all were students of Mises, because Mises held in his office, every 2 weeks, a private seminar. It was sometimes called the Mises Kreis or the Mises Circle. Okay, and all these students supposedly sat around at his feet. He also taught as a privat dozent, an unpaid lecturer at the university at the same time Hayek was there. But what you have to keep in mind is that at that time, okay, in 1918, 1919, these were students of Wieser. They were not allowed into Mises' private seminar until they had gotten their doctorates. So their economics was formed by Wieser. Hayek himself comes out and says, I was never a student of Mises. I sat in on even his university seminar. He says, I sat in on his first lecture and I didn't like his manner. So he never really took Mises. The others took Mises, Machlup and Hobler, were at the university. They took Mises' university seminar. But that that was focused on money and on socialism, two topics that Mises had written on and was writing on at that point. He had written a great book on money, and everyone recognized him as the leading Austrian theorist of money. Okay, but no one recognized Mises at that time as a general theorist who was at Schumpeter's level. Okay, Schumpeter was still seen as the most important Austrian economist. Okay. So, to say that these people were students of Mises in some sense is true, but in another sense is really not true. They were not his doctrinal students. They didn't accept Mises' doctrine. In fact, Mises hadn't really yet developed fully his view of economics. Okay? He basically followed Menger and von Bawerk, but he didn't really develop value theory and price theory, which is the core of Austrian economics. So now you have two things going on here. You have Marshall's principles beginning to roll back the Austrian influence throughout the world. And by the 1920s, in the United States and Great Britain, most of the Austrian influence, and there were very great British and American economists who had written treatises in English right around World War I. One was Frank Fetter, who was a follower of Menger and von Bawerk, who wrote a principles text. Another was Philip Wicksteed, a British economist. And the third was Herbert J. Davenport. All three of these texts came out within a few years of World War I. Okay? But after World War I, okay, they were all pretty much older men by then, and they stopped contributing to the theoretical debate. So by the 1920s, you had people who believed in Marshall's principles, and books written on textbooks that were written on the basis of Marshall's principles, being the main textbooks that were used in American universities. Okay, so the Austrian influence had pretty much died out by the late 20s, early 30s in the United States. The only place the Austrian influence continued was at the London School of Economics, where Lionel Robbins was the chairman of the department. I almost said chairperson. I forgot where I was. Lionel Robbins was the chairman of the department. And Robbins was heavily influenced, he could read German, heavily influenced by the Austrians and read them in German, and wrote a wonderful book in 1932, The Nature and Significance of Economic Science, which was basically a statement of the praxeological approach to economics. Okay? From 1928 to 1933, von Mises had begun to write on methodology, had begun to write on the general aspects of economics. So from 1928 to 1933, Mises began to be seen as someone who was a system builder. But by that time, the fourth generation of Austrian economists, Hayek, Mackler, Pabler, and Morgenstern, had already developed their own views. Okay? They all were verbal general equilibrium economists. Okay? They all had interesting things to say, but they all went back to the general equilibrium framework as a framework that they worked in. Okay? And there are quotes by them in my article on the place of human action in modern economic thought that attest to this. Okay. So what happens is that Hayek gives a series of lectures, is invited to the London School of Economics in 1930. Okay, he's only 31 years old at that point. He gives a series of lectures explaining the Great Depression, explaining Austrian business cycle theory. They're published the next year as Prices, under the title Prices and Production. And then he's invited to become a professor at the London School of Economics. So he leaves Vienna and he goes to the London School of Economics. And there he meets a young, later to be very, very influential British economist, J.R. Hicks, who was initially very Austrian-oriented because of his relationship to Lionel Robbins. And unfortunately, Hayek urges Hicks to go back to read Vilfredo Pareto. Pareto, an Italian economist, a mathematical economist, who developed Leon Walras's system. Walras was really the first one to develop a full mathematical system of economics, the Swiss economist, who wrote in 1874, as I mentioned earlier in the week. And Hicks goes back and reads this and begins to change his mind and introduces the mathematical general equilibrium theory into the English-speaking world, okay, with Hayek's urging. Okay. By 1935, even Robbins, now Robbins was a great Austrian economist in his younger days, And he wrote a great book explaining the Great Depression in 1934. It was just called The Great Depression. And it was all based on Misesian and Hayekian business cycle theory. But he's very malleable. He's very suggestible. He doesn't want to fall behind the cutting edge of what he sees to be economic theory. And he sees everyone moving towards general equilibrium theory. And in 1936, he sees the Keynesian Revolution sweeping the English-speaking world. So Robbins becomes a Keynesian. By World War II, he's a Keynesian. And if you look at his syllabus for his general theory course, by 1935, 1936, he's under the influence of Hicks and Hayek, and he's, instead of recommending books by American Austrians and British Austrians like Wicksteed and so on, he's now recommending books by mathematical economists like Hicks and Allen and others. So that's the second blow to the Austrian school, okay? Or actually, that's the third blow and final blow to the Austrian school. The London School of Economics then ceases to be Austrian. There's no more Austrian outposts in the English-speaking world, okay? Marshallian economics has triumphed on the micro half, which is the more important half of economics, okay? And then the final blow is the Keynesian Revolution. So it doesn't come out of nowhere. It's not just a big bang. The Austrian school is collapsing. It begins collapsing by 1914. Okay, it begins to collapse. I mean, that's its last gasp, I would say. All right. Now Mises sees all this going on around him, and Mises leaves goes to Geneva to teach at the Graduate Institute of International Relations, I believe, in Geneva. From 34 to 1940, when he leaves and emigrates to the United States, okay, keeping just a step ahead of the Nazi army that are chasing him through France, okay, and Portugal, and I think he winds up leaving from Portugal or something like that, because he is one of the ones that the Nazis want to get. He's one of the classical liberals who were fleeing from the advances of the Nazi armies. And he was a big personage in Austria, and they knew about Mises, and they stole his whole library collection, and so that they were actually looking for Mises. But anyway, from 1934, so he goes to Switzerland in 1934, and now he was very, very prolific. Despite the fact that he had a full-time non-academic job, Mises, and ran two seminars, Mises wrote tremendously. He wrote many books and articles up until 1934. But from 34 to 39, he writes a few newspaper articles each year, and he wrote maybe one or two academic articles. The rest of his time is spent writing Human Action. And what Human Action is, or the German predecessor, which is National Economy, and what that book is basically a restatement and reformulation of the Menger-Bombaverk view of economics that has disappeared from the scene. Okay, so he spends all his time on this, and it is published in 1940. But because of the war, there's no market for it in German-speaking countries, so it doesn't go anywhere. Okay, now what Mises basically did, and I'll quickly go through that. Mises saw a couple of problems with Menger and Bombaverk's approach. Okay, one of the problems was they never really developed a theory of money prices and of economic calculation. Okay, and so Mises does that in Human Action. He does show that how from subjective values of people and from information that entrepreneurs get about people's subjective values or forecast about people's subjective values and about technology and so on, how that information is transformed into judgments about what the prices of the factors of production should be in society, what the price of capital goods should be. In other words, He finally and definitively settles the problem of socialism. He shows that you need money prices in order to he's actually shown that already. What he shows is that where money prices actually come from. Okay, he gives us a theory of monetary calculation in that book. Okay, which Menger and Bombaverk did not do. One other thing that Menger and Bombaverk did not do was they didn't really completely understand the equilibrium concept. Basically, what Mises says is there's only one use for equilibrium, that is, an imaginary construction or an image of a world where there's no change. The only use for that is to separate interest from profit. We imagine a world where there's absolutely no change, where every day is like every other day, because that allows us to show that in that world there will be no profit, so that profit arises from change. Okay. Unfortunately, Menger and von Bauwerk acted as if the world, sometimes in some of their writings, and I don't think completely with complete understanding, they lapsed into the view that the economy was in some sort of an equilibrium. Okay. Now, if they did that, they could be easily dismissed by the more sophisticated general equilibrium economists, the mathematical general equilibrium economists like Hicks, who said, well, the Austrians are saying what we're saying. We're just saying it more precisely and more elegantly. And even Hayek falls into this trap. At one point, Hayek says, the best statement of the theory of pure choice, which is a general equilibrium theory, is the theory of the Lausanne school. That is the French school of Walras and Pareto, or the Swiss school of Walras and Pareto, okay, who are mathematical economists. Okay, so in other words, Menger and von Bauwerk look like they're second-rate general equilibrium theorists who aren't very elegant, so we can just dispense with them. We'll just use the math. Okay. So Mises shows that, in fact, the real world is continually changing. That's why you need money prices. That's why you need economic calculation. Equilibrium is simply a subsidiary construct that we use in one part of our economics. Okay, so he solves all those problems. But now there's no market for his book. It's 1949. He comes to the United States. By 1949, everyone, all the textbooks in the U.S., are basically part Marshall, okay, the first 90% of the textbooks on price theory, on supply and demand, are simply Marshallian textbooks. And then there's 10% at the end that is general equilibrium mathematics, okay, welfare theory and so on. So no one pays attention to Mises' book, okay, and the Austrian school is kept alive by Mises's in the United States by Mises' seminar, which he holds at NYU. Okay, becomes a visiting professor there and holds a weekly seminar every week. Okay, was it what, just one seminar, George? Did you ever teach two a year?
One seminar
each term. That's what I meant. Okay, per term, right? Okay, and I think he teaches through 1969. And economists, well, for example, Professor Riesman attends this seminar, so does Murray Rothbard, so does Israel Kirzner, and so on. Okay. Now, how do we, and there are a few good books, a few articles, they're very few and far between, written in the 1950s, Henry Hazlitt writes some things, Israel Kirzner writes his dissertation on the different approaches to economics, including Mises' approach. Murray Rothbard writes a very good article on a reconstruction of utility and welfare theory. There are a few things written, but there is no Austrian school to speak of. Okay. But then Rothbard, in 1962, publishes Man, Economy, and State, which he had been working on, I think, from 1954 or something like that. And right after that, 1963, publishes America's Great Depression. And then he also, in 1963, publishes a small booklet called What Has Government Done to Our Money? Which is a flourishing of genius. I mean, these works are on the one hand, they revive the Austrian approach. On the other hand, they extend and refine what Mises has said. They're very readable. And younger students now, on the college level, begin to read these works. So by 1974, the people that come to South Royalton, there's 30 people that come, almost to the man, well, there was one woman there, Karen Vaughan, almost to the person, are Rothbardians. Okay, they come to hear Rothbard. Israel Kirzner, who was the other great leader of the Austrian school in the 1970s, had just come out in 1972, or not, was it 1973? I think 1973, with his work, Competition and Entrepreneurship, which was very, very influential. Okay? But for the most part, everyone is a Rothbardian at that conference. So there was no Big Bang theory of the revival. Okay? Many people discovered, I know I did, in the 1960s when I was in college. I'd read Ayn Rand beginning in eighth grade, and I had read some of her works. But I got my hands on Capitalism, the Unknown Ideal, and there were references to Mises in that book. I had never heard of the Austrian school. I was a major in economics in college from 68 to 72, and yet, when I read Capitalism, the Unknown Ideal, must have been 69 or something like that, I did see this reference to Mises, and I don't know if it was references to Hayek there, but I followed up the references, and then there was an article in the New York Review of, actually it was in the New York Times Sunday edition, on the libertarian movement. They mentioned Murray Rothbard, so I followed up the references, and I read all his works and Hayek's works, and or as many as I could get my hands on, Mises' works. So by 1974, I was pretty much a Misesian and Rothbardian. And I think my experience is representative of the experience of others. Okay, and so what happens in 1974 then is we have this conference, and yes, it does bring everyone together, and yes, it does give another burst of energy to Austrian economics. But there are many people out there studying in small groups or on their own who are already Austrian economists in some sense. Okay, and then there are two more conferences, high-level conferences. In 1975, there's one in Hartford. 1976, there's one at Windsor Castle in England. And then those conferences stop. And at that point, the Austrian school begins to split off again into different strands of thought. And basically, going into too much more detail here, Israel Kirzner becomes sort of the dean of one strand, and Murray Rothbard is the leader of the other strand of thought. And actually, there's a third strand, Ludwig Lachmann, who was pretty much a self-professed nihilist. He didn't believe economists could say anything definite. Okay? So there was a nihilistic wing. There was Israel Kirzner, who tried to combine insights of Mises and Hayek, and I don't think I sort of reject that hybrid approach, though he's very subtle, it's very well argued. Kirzner believes the market economy is actually always moving towards equilibrium. The entrepreneur is always pushing the real-world market economy actually is moving, in a real sense, in real time, towards equilibrium. Okay, Mises rejected that. It's not really moving towards equilibrium. Equilibrium is a pure tool. Okay, no one ever looks at equilibrium prices. Entrepreneurs are not forecasting equilibrium prices. Okay, things are changing every moment, so there's no time for the economy to move. There's never a period when things stop completely from changing. Let's say maybe for a year they stop changing, and the economy begins step by step to move towards the equilibrium. But Kirzner believes that is the function of the entrepreneur to push the economy towards equilibrium, and so he has followers who follow him. Rothbard pretty much, I think, follows Menger, von Bawerk, and Mises in the main line of the Austrian school. And has a realistic price theory, and makes many other extensions, additions, and refinements of Austrian economics. Okay, and even contributions in his own right. Might say one other thing. One other quick point I want to make. I'll take a few questions. Is that Austrian economics? It is true. Is carried forward generation after generation by, in effect, geniuses. Menger is a genius. Von Bawerk is a genius, if you look at his works. So is Mises, and so is Rothbard. Okay, and they were all pretty much geniuses working in isolation in some sense. But in my second article on the rebirth of Austrian economics, I point out that genius is not enough to carry an intellectual movement forward. You need an institutional infrastructure. Okay, so when the resources stopped coming Rothbard's way in the late 1970s, it was a change in the people who were donating money to advance Austrian economics. The money began flowing to NYU and built up a PhD program at NYU, and then later on in the early 1980s at George Mason. These two strands of Austrian economics developed very, very quickly, and the Rothbardian strand went into eclipse. Okay, it began to fall. It wasn't until 1983 when Lou Rockwell pretty much saw what was going on, saw that the Misesian, pure Misesian strand of Austrian economics was dying out, that he started the von Mises Institute. Okay, and so now there were more resources going in that direction, and there's nothing wrong with resources. Resources, as Menger pointed out, you need resources to achieve any end, including the discovery of economic truth. Okay, you need journals, you need conferences like this. Okay, you need libraries. And so on. Okay. So in 1986, we had another great institution established, the Review of Austrian Economics, which later became, it started as a yearbook once a year. It later went to two per year, and now is now the Quarterly Journal of Economics, of Austrian Economics, and is published four times a year. Okay? And it's an outlet for many young Austrian scholars. So without the institution of the Mises Institute, okay, and all its associated activities, Rothbardian economics or Misesian economics, I think, would again grind to a halt and begin to disintegrate. Okay? So the point of my second article is that you need resources, and that changes in resource allocations explains the fluctuations in the fortunes of the different strands of Austrian economics after in the revival, during the revival.